Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, December 6th, 2012. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week, is your home brew not clear enough for you? Chris Colby, editor of Brew Your Own magazine, and I talk about filtering your beer. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Basic Brewing, all one word. On Facebook, I am at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. We have the Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing video page on Facebook as well at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon Associate link on our basicbrewing.com site, especially during this busy, busy holiday season. Whenever you think of shopping on Amazon, think of us first. Go to our website, find the Amazon banner on basicbrewing.com. Click on that. That will take you to Amazon. And whatever you purchase there during that little session, we will get a hunk of. And we greatly appreciate your support in that way. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show. Very helpful. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. And our iPhone and Android podcast apps are on their respective stores. You can also find the Basic Brewing Android app on the Amazon.com store as well. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, and we're on the Stitcher app as well. The new Basic Brewing Brewers logbooks are in the house and going out the door. Our 2013 logbooks are a bit of a departure from our past versions. In the past, we've tied each edition to a particular year, but this year we're making them sort of timeless. You still get 12 two-page spreads of monthly calendars in the front, but those months are blank. So no matter if you buy the book in January or July, you still get a full year's worth of planning your brewing, and you still get room in the back of the book to fully document 50 batches of homebrew. One more innovation this year, we've put a blank table of contents in the front so you can list your batches by page number and quickly get to them rather than having to thumb through, 50 batches of brew sessions to find that one that you are looking for. And many thanks to those of you who have been picking them up. The people in line behind me at the post office are a little miffed when they see me and my armload of packages bellied up to the counter, but it's very gratifying to Steve and me that they are so popular, and it's very nice to see the names of repeat customers, especially coming through the shop, and I'm very glad that you find the logbooks useful. I'm also getting a bunch of brewing disaster stories through email. Steve and I are planning to do our end-of-the-year brewing disaster show, sharing your tales of woe around the brew pot, and what you did to salvage your bad brew day. Or sometimes not. I haven't had any news stories this year of exploding airlocks or exploding carboys or bucket lids hitting the ceiling. So maybe that means the past stories of clogged airlocks and blow-off tubes are having an effect. Could it be that if we share enough brewing disaster stories, we'll eliminate them altogether? Nah. Send your brewing disaster stories to james@basicbrewing.com or use the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please, if you can have them to me by Friday, December 14th, I would greatly appreciate it. Let's take a look into the mailbag at a couple of things. Tom from Lexington, Kentucky, who is a member of the Brewers of Central Kentucky, or BOC, writes in after hearing the show with Bob Stemsky's experiment comparing late wort hopping with dry hopping. Tom writes about his own experiment. He says, "On November 11th, I made back-to-back 5-gallon batches. The first batch followed my tried-and-true IPA recipe, 60-minute bittering addition with Centennial to 70 IBUs using Tinsith, 10-minute additions, an addition at 10 minutes before the end of the boil of 1 ounce of Citra and 1 ounce of Cascade, 1 minute before the end of the boil, 1 ounce of Citra and 1 ounce of Cascade. Immersion chilled, 2, and fermented at 63 degrees Fahrenheit with San Diego Super Yeast." Tom says, "In the second batch, I moved all the late addition hops to dry hops and I adjusted the 60-minute bittering edition, again with Centennial, to 70 IBUs using Tenseth. Immersion chilled, too, and fermented at 60 degrees Fahrenheit with San Diego Super Yeast, as before. Tom says, I started dry hopping at day 7 of fermentation. The fermentation was pretty much complete by this point, with 1 ounce of Sintra and 1 ounce of Cascade. When I transferred to the keg at day 14, I added another 1 ounce of Sintra and 1 ounce of Cascade. Both kegs were force carbonated. They were not quite carbonated when I first started tasting samples. I can definitely say these are two different beers. The dry-hopped version reminds me of some extreme-hopped commercial beers like Pliny, Hop Slam, and Hoptimum. Yum. I gave samples of each batch to a group of friends this past weekend. They seemed to prefer the dry-hopped version. I plan to take samples to the local homebrew club meeting coming up next week. Tom says I might try to do a talk on the experiment, ask for written feedback. That would be very interesting, very cool. I'm curious to hear what the homebrew club members say and giving their feedback. This makes me want to try an experiment with my own homebrew even more. I appreciate the info, Tom. Tom sounds like he's endorsing leaving out the late wort hops and just shifting those hops to the dry hopping, as did Bob Stemsky. So there you go. Matt from Lehigh Valley, Pennsylvania, writes with this. The main reason I'm emailing you is that I tried your 15-minute pale ale technique and used it for a cranberry ale I like to call Turkey Chaser. Now, if you're not familiar with the 15-minute pale ale, it's an extract beer, so you don't need to boil extract for a whole hour. I use dry malt extract and then use my standard pale ale recipe. Double the amount of hops I would have used at 60 minutes and then put those at the beginning of that 15-minute boil. And then the rest of the hopping is the same. And that gives you a nice hoppy beer and a short brew day. Anyway, Matt says, this is my second annual Thanksgiving Day brew. Last year I did a full extract boil with hop additions and used cranberry extract during bottling to give it the cranberry flavoring. This year, I waited a little too long and was running out of time, so I remembered your 15-minute technique for extracts, and I decided to give it a shot. I must say, since trying the 15-minute extract boil, I don't think I will ever do a 60-minute boil with extract again. Typically, I'm an all-grain brewer, Matt says. It allowed me to knock out two and a half gallon batches in the same time it would for me to do a full 60-minute boil. So two beers for the time of one. The recipes for the beers were very simple. I made two types, an amber turkey chaser and a light turkey chaser. For both, I just used 3 pounds of dry malt extract, amber for one and light for the other, 1 ounce of Satz hops added at start of boil, 1 packet of US05 ale yeast. And again, these are two and a half gallon batches. Matt says, during bottling, I added one bottle of Simply Cranberry cocktail juice and primed each bottle with one carb drop. Both finished around 4.5% to 5% ABV, and the end result tasted good as well as turned out to be a big hit during Thanksgiving. The bottles were slightly overcarbed due to the sugar within the cranberry cocktail. I was wondering about that. For next year, I think I'll use the same technique, but add the simple cranberry to the fermenter a day or two before bottling and allow the yeast to eat up the available sugars from the juice. The finished beer was very similar to that of a shandy. That sounds tasty, Matt. Like I say, I was wondering about the over-carbonation risk by adding the juice at bottling time without letting the yeast eat that sugar. It is much safer to add to the fermenter and let the yeast work on that additional sugar before priming and then bottling, unless you listen to our alternative priming show and figure out, I guess you could just prime with the cranberry juice by itself if you knew how much to add. Matt's recipe comes with good timing. At the end of my chat with the Chris Colby on filtering beer, we rambled on a bit. And Chris gave us his recipe for a similar holiday brew. Chris Colby, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me on the show.
We're going to talk about filtering homebrew. The professionals filter most styles of beer, so why shouldn't we, right?
Sure. It's possible.
It's this article by Dave Miller, who has a new book out, Brew Like a Pro, which means I probably need to get a copy of that book and talk to Dave about that. But filtration in homebrewing is kind of a controversial topic, is it not?
To some people, yeah. The majority of homebrewers, and I would guess the vast majority, don't filter their beer. I know I don't. I never have. You know, because if you know how to make beer well and you keg it or bottle it and let it sit cold somewhere for, usually a week or so, it drops, maybe not 100% crystal clear, but it drops very, very clear. And for most homebrewers, that's good enough. The added step of filtering, is enough of a pain in the butt. Plus, just the added expense of the filtration equipment, for most people means they're not going to do that. But if you really want to go that last little bit and get, absolutely 100% clear, crystal clear homebrew that you can, hold up a glass and stick a pencil on the other side and read, what's written on the pencil, that kind of clarity, filtering would be the way to go.
Of course, for a lot of us, if butt pain and expense were barriers to us, we wouldn't be in home brewing to begin with. So,
yeah, that's true. And I mean, a lot of people go to lengths in other parts of the hobby. In the past, I've grown my own hops and even barley. A lot of people take a lot of time fabricating their own, brew house. So it's not, the amount of work involved in filtration isn't, way out of the realm of possibility. It's just something that most homebrewers don't choose because it's at a time expense and there's a little bit of loss of beer involved, because inevitably some of it, gets left in the lines or dissolved in the filter and that kind of stuff.
So what are the benefits? Why go to all the trouble and expense?
The only reason I could think of would be is if you really want just crystal clear beer. There's flavor wise, it doesn't really change the flavor at all. In fact, it may very, very slightly scrub out a few things. But yeah, it's really just a matter of appearance.
Yeah, Dave says that it does have a little bit of an impact on, it has a big impact on clarity, obviously. But it also has some impacts on flavor and maybe aroma and maybe perhaps body. But his argument is, pardon me, that if you filter on a regular basis, you're going to develop your recipes around that and you're going to compensate.
Sure. Yeah. If you filter every batch and you taste your pale ale and you say, I think it needs a little more crystal hops, crystal malt, I'm sorry. You just add that and it would be, you just factored into your whole process. Yeah. So it's, I don't think the amount of, or another way of putting it, a better way of putting it, I think people overstate the amount of things that get stripped from beer when it's filtered. I mean, at the filtration size, at the pore size you're talking about, you're not filtering out like molecules or anything. Everything that gives beer its flavor is going to go through. A little bit might get hung up in the filter media, but not much, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, if you put beer in one side of the filter and the other side came out RO water, that'd be a problem.
Yeah,
he filtered everything but the water molecules out of the. That'd be bad. There are plenty commercial beers out there that are wonderful and wonderfully hoppy, and the commercial brewers use filtration. Of course, they also use centrifuges as well.
Yep.
So there's other technology to their that they use to their advantage. But so you get, I mean, you're essentially buying time, I guess, is one way to look at it. I mean, if you, like you said, if you put your beer, your finished beer, in a carboy or a keg and put it in the fridge or the kegerator and let it settle for a long time, it's going to get pretty darn clear. I mean, anybody who kegs, you know that the last, I mean, if a keg lasts for a good long time, the last beers that you pull out of there are much more clear than the first ones that you get out. So you're essentially, this process, it's a lot more trouble and effort and some more expense, but you're essentially buying time.
Yeah, you you can start drinking your crystal clear beer a little bit sooner. Yeah, you don't have to wait for that last beer you pull out of the keg, and then you're like, that's great, and then you go and start pouring foam with the next glass. Start cursing.
Yeah, finally, this beer is exactly the way. Oh, yeah. Man. So what are our options? I mean, what are we talking filter-wise?
There's two sort of homebrewers that do filter. There's two routes to go. There's one that it's basically these two plastic housing things that clamp together and hold a big, relatively big sheet of what's essentially thick filter paper between it, and you pump the beer through that filter that way. And the second kind is basically just it's the same idea as, you know, your under sink water filter, but there are filters that are made like that, but to filter beverages. And so it's, you know, the same sort of filter housing as, you know, you would alter to make a Randall or something, or, you know. So those are the two basic kinds of filters.
And Dave spends most of his time talking about the cartridge filters. The sheet filters are less complex as far as the setup and all. And you're basically just assembling the sheet between in its little housing there and just pushing the beer through using CO2, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you take the filter and you need to wet it first. Then you assemble the equipment, and then you need to pump you need to push sanitizing solution through the whole thing. And then perhaps a little water to rinse it, depending on how you do it. That's really kind of up to you. And then you push the beer through. You let the first little bit that's, you know, mixed with sanitizing solution, you know, you divert it away from your receiving keg. And then you, you know, once you're getting clear beer, move the receiving tube to your receiving keg, which you've hopefully purged with CO2, and then, you know, let the beer flow into that.
Mm-hmm. So right there, the first expense would be the filter and the housing.
Filter itself, and then, yeah, for some of those kind of filters, the filters aren't really that reusable. You need to buy like a new pad. I don't know for sure if it's every time but they get clogged pretty soon.
And then you've got another expense in that you have to have an additional keg to push the beer from. You can't just rack out of a carboy through the filter. You've got to push it, so you first have to rack out of the carboy into a sanitized keg, and then push it using CO2 through the filter into the keg that you're eventually going to be serving in.
Right, you need two kegs, yep.
So cartridge filters, though, they sound like the kind of higher-tech, more reusable solution.
Yeah, the one he talks about especially, you can apparently just, you know, you filter, and then you sort of run liquid sanitizing solution or cleaning solution through it backwards at the end and sort of rinse out everything you've filtered. And, you know, according to him, it's reusable.
Yeah, you've seen these kind of cartridges if you've gone to the homebrew conference, or if you've seen video of the homebrew conference. You know, people are using these water filters as kind of their own, you know, Randall the enamel animal kind of thing, where they put hops and fruits, and I've even seen roasted peppers and, you know, whatever into those filter housings. You'd actually put a filter in to do something radical and put a filter in the filter housing to filter your beer that way.
Yeah. He one thing he mentions, though, he says he's tried the straight up like water filter varieties, and he says those don't work very well. The ones that are designed to for whatever reason, the ones that are designed to use for use with water don't do very well. But he bought one, and he mentions the name in the article. Those specifically designed for beverages.
Graver Technologies.
Yeah.
The 0.5 micron unit, he says, costs $45 plus shipping. So, you know, it's a fairly substantial investment.
Yeah, not too bad.
But, you know, if you can reuse it and if you take care of it, you should be okay. And one thing he does recommend is on the filter housings, the plastic filter housings, because the seal, I guess, between the unfiltered side and the filtered side is kind of delicate. You want to make sure that you don't, you know, bang that around too much, or you'll be kind of shortcutting or short-circuiting your efforts on that side.
Yeah, one interesting advantage that he mentions with the cartridge filters is that because the cartridge is a pressure vessel, you can filter carbonated beer with it. I mean, when I think of filtering beer, I usually think of, you know, you rack it from the carboy to a keg, and it's not, you know, it doesn't have anything other than the, you know, residual CO2 from fermentation in it. But with a cartridge filter, you can have your keg carbonated and then filter it.
So what are the steps? I mean, what are the, when you're using one of these cartridge filters, let's get into the nitty-gritty. I mean, what are the steps that you've got to go through?
Yeah, basically you need to – it's kind of two steps or two overall big steps. One is taking the what he calls the racked beer keg, which is like your unfiltered beer keg, filling that with a sanitizing solution and pumping it all over to your receiving keg through the filter. So you sanitize the filter that way, and then you take the receiving keg that's full of sanitizing solution and push that out with CO2. So when you're done, you've got a sanitized filter, there's sanitizing solution running through the tubes, and you've got the receiving keg that's full of CO2, so that as you... Because one potential downside to filtering is if you do it wrong, you'll end up oxidizing your beer. Mm-hmm. Like if you just took the filter dry, hooked it up to the racked beer keg and the receiving beer keg, and, you know, there was air in the receiving beer keg, and just, you know, sort of pushed it so that it splashed through the filter and all that, it would pick up all that oxygen that was in the tubes leading there and in the filter itself, because there would be oxygen entrained in the filter mesh, and that would end up in your beer. So you've got to, you know, push a dilute sanitizing solution through to, you know, it does a little bit of sanitizing, but mostly you're displacing the oxygen and getting it ready. And then once you've done that with sanitizing solution, you essentially repeat the entire thing but this time with beer. And like I said, you just you start moving. At first, you're going to have some sanitizing solution, so you don't. The first things that come off, you'll just let, you know, spray into your little bucket or whatever. But then, once beer starts coming out, then put the, you know, the little keg lock thing on the receiving beer keg, and then start filling it.
And then afterwards, after you get that all transferred over, you put your nice finished keg at pressure into the refrigerator. And then to clean, you just basically take the thing apart and soak it in PBW for a while, right?
Yeah, that's what he recommends. I've never done this before, so I'm going on what, you know, PC said and what I've seen other people do. But yeah, I think, and sometimes people, depending on the filter and depending on how many times you're going to try to reuse it, some people might try to take like water or light sanitizing solution and push it backwards through the filter just to sort of knock out some of the things they filtered and give the if it's a non-reusable filter, you can extend the life sometimes a little bit that way. Although you really start running a risk if you're trying to reuse something that's meant to be disposable.
So what if we're homebrewers and we don't want to go to the additional time and trouble and expense and effort to get really clear beers? I mean, what are the other alternatives? I mean, besides time.
You can fine your beer. There's different finings like Isinglass, which, if I recall, gets rid of mainly yeast sediment. There's polyvinyl something pyridodone, PVPP. That's if I recall, that's this. It's the same plastic they use as the coating of when you swallow like a pill, but it's shredded, and you put that through your homebrew, and that'll filter out a lot of things, or not filter out, but fine out some things. So yeah, your options are either filtering, fining, or time. That's
and
really it.
Also gelatin. I've used gelatin in the past.
Yeah, gelatin.
You essentially boil up some water and mix in a packet of unflavored, you know, when you use like lime gelatin. you don't want to use the flavor gelatin, but the
unless you're making Bud Light lime,
which may be an idea. if you made your beer with Jell-O, maybe Bill Cosby could help you advertise Jell-O beer pops. And the one thing about gelatin is that when you use the unflavored stuff, you really get a reminder of what it is when you put it in boiling water by itself, because you really get kind of that horse's hoof kind of cow bone sort of smell. But that doesn't translate into your beer. And I find I have found a pretty cloudy pale ale in quite a hurry. I mean, it works pretty quickly. But the drawback in my experience from using these fining agents is that you get a thicker layer of sediment on the bottom of your carboy that you got to leave behind. You got to be careful and leave behind. So you do, or at least in my experience, you do sort of waste some beer in doing that way. Is that your experience as well?
Yeah, I've used PVPP before, and it does settle out. At first, it settles out into like a very thick layer almost, but then it just kind of compacts. But it does that really quickly. I mean, with PVPP, you can do it like one day or even at night, and then by the morning, it's pretty much compacted down into its layer. But the neat thing is if you have it in a carboy and, you know, you are just curious, you can go watch it like hour after hour, you know, just every hour or so or half hour, go look at. And it's kind of cool because you see it. If your beer is clear enough to start with, you see the gradient of clarity in the carboy develop.
I've never spent long periods of time looking at my carboy during any part of the brewing process. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
you know you're a beer geek. You know you're a homebrew nerd if you spend a lot of time drinking homebrew, watching the yeast fly around in your glass carboy.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have notes on like how many bubbles per minute are coming out of my carboy at different hours or something from when I started. No, I can't relate to that at all.
It's alive. Even today, when I get a successful fermentation going, I'm just like fascinated. It worked again. I did it again.
And I like with some yeasts, like 1968, you sometimes get that. I sort of call it a lava lamp fermentation where you have the big clumps of yeast going churning up and down, and you watch them. It's like, pretty.
Which would be an appropriate analogy for 1968.
Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. So have you run through your supply of Thanksgiving turkeys yet?
Not yet. I've still got a couple left.
You stocked up.
I made turkey on Thanksgiving, and then about a week later, I made two more turkeys. Because I like turkey.
I was going to say you're a glutton for punishment, but you just may be a glutton.
I'm just a glutton, yeah.
Well, I trust you had a good Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it was fun. How was yours?
It was good. I ate a bunch, and then we ate a bunch more. And we didn't fight too much with the family. So some football was watched. And, you know, there you go.
Usually I brew my cranberry beer right around Thanksgiving, but I didn't have time this year. I was kind of bummed.
We'll talk about that a little bit. That's
next.
That's back on the subject, on the topic. But how do you make a cranberry beer?
It's real easy. You just make a light wheat beer base. And I mean, I've done everything from making an all-grain batch of wheat beer to just dissolving wheat malt extract. I usually make it, you know, around 10-44 starting gravity, lightly hopped since it's going to be a cranberry beer. And then what I do, you know, just ferment it out. And you can go either with an actual wheat yeast, or I usually just use a clean ale yeast, you know, for an American wheat style. But then basically you just make cranberry relish. You take a bunch of cranberries for a 5-gallon batch. I don't know, but my recipe's on the web somewhere. But it's a few pounds of cranberries, and then you take a Granny Smith apple and an orange, and you cut them up. And the orange, you cut the whole thing up, like including the rind that you leave in, and you mix that with the cranberries. You know, send it through a Cuisinart, a food processor. I usually do it I don't grind it into the smallest possible thing because it's going to have some contact time with the beer for extraction. But, you know, like coarsely grind it up, the cranberries, the apple, and the orange. And then just rack the wheat beer on top of it. I usually, you know, the wheat beer is, since it's relatively low in gravity, it's going to ferment pretty quickly. I like to rack it on out pretty much right when primary fermentation ends.
Mm-hmm.
Get it in there. And the fruit has a little bit of sugar in it, and that's going to restart a secondary fermentation. Do the secondary in a bucket, and a bucket with a good, like, couple gallons of headspace. And then I give it a fruit contact time of maybe like 5 days or so, because this beer is like not something that, you know, you make to age forever or anything.
Right.
It's quick. It's easy to make. You know, the base beer can be as easy as, and it might as well be as easy as just dissolving malt extract, because you're not at the level of cranberries that kind of takes over most of the flavor. And so about fruit contact of about 5 days. Yeah, then just move the beer to a keg from there. And yeah, when we're talking about filtration and beer loss, yeah, when you put like 4 pounds of cranberry relish in a bucket, be prepared for the next level of beer loss. It's not, another reason not to put too much effort into the wheat beer is because you do lose a good chunk of that. But you can, you know, with a little bit of patient racking, you can get a lot, you know, most of it out of there. And it's just a decent, you know, different kind of beer. It's just tart, you know, tastes like cranberries. You know, you can taste the little hint of the apple and the orange in there. And you can even, if you want to get fancy, you can sort of put it in a keg and instead of dry hopping it, cut up another like a quarter of an orange, including the peel and all that, and part of an apple, and then sort of dry, you know, you don't really need any more cranberries, but, you know, dry fruit it as opposed to dry hopping it, and that works pretty well.
Wow.
You get the, especially the orange aromas will come out of the, not necessarily the rind, but the peel.
That does sound tasty. Now, you could also, I guess if you wanted to, less effort would be to do, say, a standard basic wheat beer and just use like a cranberry juice cocktail or something like that as a mixer and do like, what do they call them, the shandies sort of thing, where you could just mix fruit juice at serving time.
Yeah, you could probably try that.
You're a little skeptical about that, I can tell. But
I think the big difference is that those, if you take a cranberry, like, you know, Ocean Spray or whatever, those have a lot of sugar in them.
Mm-hmm.
And when you mix the beer in that, you're going to have, it's going to be more sweet, where this is, the beer is more dry.
That's true. That's true.
But it's, I mean, you could do it.
It's worth a shot. What the heck?
Yeah. I'd cut up and that'd be like the one beer that I would use an orange garnish on if I was going to do the sweet way.
Well, there you go. We've come full circle, I think. Or maybe more of a Mobius loop kind of a deal. But well, I appreciate it. This article is an excerpt from Dave's book, or it's excerpted from Dave's Brew Like a Pro book.
Mm-hmm. Just came out, as far as I know.
All kinds of good stuff out there to read. All right, Chris. Well, we will talk to you next time.
Okay. Talk to you then.
Well, thanks again to Chris. If you'd like to have a free issue of Brew Your Own magazine, you can click on the ad on basicbrewing.com. And if you decide to subscribe after reading that issue, you'll be helping to support this show. And much appreciate everybody who does that. Don't forget to send us your brewing disasters stories. You can send them to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can also send your show suggestions or brewing questions or whatever to that address as well. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. You can check out our basic brewing shirts in the store, too. And our new Brewers Logbooks are on the store, available to order as well. They are going out now. Really excited about that. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com, and if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We greatly appreciate the support. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Barely There Women's Flex-to-Fit Bikini Soft Taupe and Simplicity Boye Electric Yarn Ball Winder. And don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by our buddy Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.
Jell-O pudding!